Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, Stavem, it's good to have you along. Welcome to the program. Today, we're going to spend a little time just talking finances, financial freedom, good stewardship, all those things. And we'd love to have you join the conversation, by the way. We'll open up the phone lines here right away. We've got 45 minutes with our guest who is back with us again. We always enjoy the opportunity to talk with Chuck Bentley from Crown Financial Ministries. But it may be that there's been a question that's come up in your life circumstance, and you'd just like to get some input on that. You're welcome to join in at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. We're going to jump right in because I always enjoy the times to talk with Chuck Bentley. You hear him just before the program on My Money Life, that daily feature is heard on hundreds of stations. And Chuck is the CEO of Crown Financial Ministries. He's been with the Crown since the last, I think, about 16, 17 years or so, and has been the CEO since 2007. Author of several books, including The Root of Riches, The Worst Financial Mistakes in the Bible, and How You Can Avoid Them. And he's also written The Salt Plan, How to Prepare for a Crisis of Biblical Proportions. Also has been the producer of the God Provides film series, and he travels. Actually, he's been traveling around the globe. He probably doesn't even know what day it is because the Crown Ministry is having a significant impact around the world. And we're glad for that, talking biblical principles on a daily basis. And that's why we appreciate the opportunity to connect with Chuck. Welcome back, Chuck. Good to talk with you today.
Neil, it's always a pleasure. I so appreciate our partnership with Faith Radio, and it's a joy. Every time I get a call that you want to talk with me, I think I'm the one being honored today, so it's my privilege.
Well, I did want to highlight something that I found on your website. You have an offer for how to invest under the Trump administration, and I thought, well, that would be a good place to start. So is there anything different under this administration than maybe in previous administrations?
Well, what happened? I began to read all the news reports that optimism was at an all-time high. I think you saw that recent report as well. We're seeing people optimistic about the economy and the markets like we haven't seen for maybe 20, 30, 40 years. And that optimism is driven by the stated agenda that President Trump said he's going to pursue. He's going to pursue lower taxes, lower bureaucracy, business-friendly environment. And so people are taking him at his word, and they believe he's going to drive that agenda. So we're seeing a lot of optimism, and that's fueling the market. We've seen record high after record high. So based on that information and that context, I interviewed three experts, people who regularly invest in the markets, and asked them their opinion. And I got some common denominators, Neil. The first common denominator was that they believe we're going to see an economic recovery, meaning jobs growth. Small business is going to survive and thrive, but they think there's going to be a difference with the market growth. In other words, they're going to uncouple from one another. We'll have economic growth, but the market is probably going to go through some necessary correction. So that really helped me to temper some of my optimism and some of my enthusiasm as an investor. It's not always going to just go up, up, up the way it has been since the inauguration.
And I've just seen some reports not too long ago saying, well, maybe it's after the health care bill didn't gain traction, that they're saying, well, maybe it's time for a correction to start taking place. The reality is investments are always doing some sort of correcting, aren't they?
They are, Neil, and you're right. In fact, this morning the big news was that since the health care legislation was turned away, that possibly he's not going to be able to drive this agenda that people are so excited about. And I think it's way too early to tell. As of today, as we're speaking right now, the markets are starting to rebound. So that optimism is pretty deeply rooted. And I would say what Warren Buffett said recently rings true with me. And it's never good to bet against the American economy. It's been steadily improving over time for the past several, for over a century, faithfully growing. And he believes it's going to continue to do so over time. And so what's different about today's investing in today's market is I think it's good to be optimistic about economic growth, but cautious about the market. I think a correction is overdue. I've been expecting one for some time. I try to diversify my investments where I'm not going to get hurt if the market corrects substantially, but I can also grow and benefit as the market grows. So I feel like that's a good position to be in. I know it sounds like I'm saying drive with one foot on the brake and one foot on the gas, but that's pretty much what I'm trying to communicate.
That's that isn't the way you drive normally, though, is it? I don't want to drive behind you if you're that guy.
No. I don't drive that way, but I tend to invest that way.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the books that you've written is called Thrive: How to Do Well in Any Economy, and I guess it probably reminds us that optimism and pessimism kind of goes with the wind and maybe based on the news. So, are there some foundational principles that we should hang on to, regardless of whether it's up or down?
Yeah, I think so. I'm going through an experience right now with an investment that my wife and I decided to make, and it's a really good story because all the fundamentals of that company are in place, and we believe it's a good long-term investment for us. We've done our analysis. We understand not only how they're doing financially today, but their projections seem to be on track to grow into the future. The management is strong. The product offerings are being well received. So we've made an investment in that company for the long term. But when you look at the market, it fluctuates on daily news. It'll go up and it'll go down. And some people will jump in and some people will jump out. And yet we're not swayed by that. The Bible says to know the condition of your flocks. And that means if you're a shepherd, you go out in the field and you look. You know what's going on. You know the threats. You know if there's a problem or challenges, and you fix those things. And I think that is the way we have to continue investing today. In fact, it's easier than it used to be to get that kind of information. If we're really informed, if we do our due diligence, if we invest in things that we understand, I think that Christian investors are going to do very well under the Trump administration and under, in fact, any administration. There's no corollary between market growth and which party is in office. The market tends to grow under any administration, presidential administration. So the important biblical principle, I think, is to know the condition of your flocks, meaning get informed, know what you're investing in, and then to be diversified, not to get so excited that you put all your eggs in one basket. And those principles still hold true today.
I think sometimes we maybe have questions about, should we be pursuing an investment strategy? I mean, maybe we go back to the parable of the talents. What does it mean to not bury our talent in the sand? Is it all about investing in the stock market?
Not just the stock market, Neil. I think that we should invest in the things that God has gifted us at. I know small business owners who are constantly reinvesting in their companies. They're buying assets. They're buying they're expanding their territory, opening new offices, and I think that's appropriate for them. There's others who understand real estate. There are others who understand precious metals. I know people who are very, very good at trading currencies. That's something I don't know anything about, so I stay out of that. If you understand the market, if you understand how to buy stocks, then I think it's a good place to invest your money. I don't think there's anything wrong with investing. The parable of the talents talks about the multiplication of resources for the glory of God and for God's purposes. I think investing for greed, I think investing to lay up for ourselves treasures on earth is wrong. I think to tear down one barn and build bigger barns is wrong, but not to multiply what God has given us. And I think being a good investor enables us to do that. But I always give the caveat, Neil, you better be a good saver before you're a good investor, because saving money is money that you're not going to put at risk. You're going to have that as a cushion. You're going to have that set aside for emergency needs before you become an investor and put money at risk.
In the moments ahead, we'll talk about some ways that we can manage our household budgets a little better. I mean, the president's trying to deal with some budget issues, a lot of big ticket items there, a lot of fixed expenses. And, we have a lot of fixed expenses too in our lives. So We'll get practical and tangible, some ways that we can be better stewards of the resources that we have and maybe experience more financial freedom. Now, you may have a question, whether it's investing or it's budgeting or whatever it might be. We're talking with Chuck Bentley today, CEO of Crown Financial Ministries, and we'd love to have you join the conversation with a phone call at 877-933-2484. It's 877-93-FAITH. Or if you want to just submit a question, if that's more convenient, you can do that by going to the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com. Go to myfaithradio.com, click on the Connecting Faith show page, and there's an email link there. You can submit your questions. We talk to Chuck Bentley. We'll talk about Thrive, how to do well in any economy. We'll talk about the SALT plan, how to prepare for a crisis of biblical proportions, and more. Our conversation with Chuck Bentley continues in just a moment. Finances, financial freedom today, investing, stewardship, all those things with Chuck Bentley, CEO of Crown Financial Ministries and author of several books. And he's a frequent speaker of both churches and business leaders on biblical financial topics. And in addition to his responsibilities as CEO at Crown, he's also the founder and executive director of the Christian Economic Forum. It's an annual gathering of selected marketplace leaders dedicated to improving the world through the advancement of ideas that work, with a focus on God's economic principles. And we'll have Chuck maybe share a little bit about some of his travels here in a moment. But, Chuck, I would like to talk maybe a bit about just the federal budget because, you know, it's beyond our comprehension, as is the deficit. And there seems like there's a lot of fixed expenses. And I'm wondering, you know, if there's a way that, you know, the president can actually spur the economy on and our Congress and yet get a handle on that deficit. What are your assessments?
Well, I think we have a tremendous problem with our deficit. We have, I think, now approaching $19 trillion in deficit for the federal government. And those were numbers I used in astronomy back when I was in elementary school. You know, nobody talked in numbers that huge. We couldn't imagine that would be the deficit for this country. And then, of course, Neil, you and I go back to the 70s when we were once the greatest creditor nation in the world, when we didn't owe anybody, and we were loaning money to the whole world. So we turned it upside down, and the sad part is there's no end in sight for the deficit spending of the government. I think people are hopeful that President Trump is going to bring sanity to that process, to start talking about a balanced budget, to start talking about reduced deficits. There's only several things the government can do. You know, they can tax, they can try to collect more money from us. President Trump is discussing how to actually tax us less. They can print money, which we're hoping they stop doing that. They can borrow money, and we're hoping they stop doing that. And the real area of focus for President Trump is to grow the economy so that there's more people in the system paying in taxes and growing the amount of resources the government has through real economic growth. That's the only good long-term solution that the government has, and that's what we're hoping will take place. One of the problems with people dropping out of the workforce is that means there's fewer taxpayers. So if you start dividing this massive deficit by the number of people who pay taxes, which I think it's about 123 million, we have 300 million in population, but there's a lot of people that don't pay taxes, and actually they're net receivers from the government. So when you divide it by the limited number of taxpayers we have, we realize that it's a huge, huge problem, and we need to pray for our president, pray for our country, and to do our part. You know, we're near tax time. I just completed my taxes last week, and the government got a pretty good share of it. And I don't give that to them begrudgingly. I thank God for this country and what they provide with our tax money. And I'm glad that I'm able to pay taxes. I know that that sounds like a strange attitude towards it, but those funds go to Caesar. And we thank God that we're in a country where we still have opportunity to work and that they're providing for us a safe place to live. And so we should pay our taxes and be grateful for what the government's doing.
Well, I guess on the individual level, we can't print money, certainly borrowing, but, you know, many of us are kind of in the same boat as the federal government is, that all these fixed expenses. And so there's it feels like it's there's limited things that we can do if we want to get our financial house in order. Do you have some maybe first steps?
Well, I do. I think first step for getting our own financial house in order is exactly what I'd like to see the federal government do, and that's to stop overspending and learn to save. I always tell Americans when I'm speaking here at home that we've got high incomes. We've got lots of money compared to the rest of the world. You and I live better than kings did in the past. You know, we've got automated tools on our desk. We've got ease of transportation. We've got comfortable housing. We've got safety, lots of money, but we have no margin. We have 70% of Americans that don't have $1,000 in cash savings. And so I'm encouraging people to save $1,000. That's 10 $100 bills, Neil. Just set them aside and don't spend them and start a new habit. I think saving your way out of debt is the way to go. Many people say, well, I've got to attack the debt. I feel stress about my debt. But the reality is you have to learn to spend less than you make and start a savings habit. Once that habit is established, then you can prevent you from falling back on credit card debt and going further into the hole. And to me, that's the real first step of financial wisdom and to freedom, is to learn to save some money. Wouldn't it be wonderful if our government would do that? They just announced, you know, next year we're not only not going to overspend, we're going to set some money aside in case difficult times are ahead. I think there would be, you know, just shouts of hallelujah all across the land for our government to make that kind of decision.
Well, has it just come over time? I mean, we have one of the lowest savings rates in the globe, right? Was that just because there hasn't been the incentive to save?
Yeah, we have one of the lowest savings rates of any developed country in the world. The Chinese savings rate is 10 times higher than the American rate. In fact, a little bit greater. Their average is about 50% of their income. Americans are averaging about 4 to 4.5% of our income. And I think it's because we have a lot of safety nets. We believe that if we can pay down the credit card and keep the balance low, and we've got a little margin left on that credit card, that that's a savings account. When in fact, it's not really a savings account. It's just an emergency escape, but it will dig a deeper hole for you. So I'm encouraging people to have the discipline to set aside the $1,000 and then to grow that savings account. I've said before in one of the books that I wrote, I think it's wise to have 15 to 16 months of your annual income in a savings account. Now, to me, that's the maximum amount that a person should set aside in saving. And after that, you need to become an investor, start investing that money. But we're seeing people today who think that that's impossible. Neil, if you have $10,000 in the bank right now, you're in the top 15% of savers in America. And to me, that's not too difficult of a goal for people to strive towards, to have at least $10,000 set aside in savings.
Well, as you talk about that base rate, that $1,000 savings account, that represents your emergency fund, right? Because all of us are going to have some issues come up at some point. You know, the refrigerator goes out or the car needs new tires or something.
Yeah, what happens, Neil, is people put money away in long-term savings. So they think because they have a 401k or an IRA or some sort of instrument where they put money away in a tax-deferred mechanism that they've got savings. And what they really have is a long-term investment, because if they try to access that money, they get penalized really badly. And so it doesn't make sense to put aside money long-term into an investment plan like that if you don't have liquidity, if you have no financial margin. So the $1,000 is money you can touch tomorrow. If I said, in fact, I just did a program about this new phenomenon of mobile phone insurance, for replacement insurance that's being rolled into all the sales of new phones. And the company is thriving because people don't have $500 to write a check to replace their phone. So they're buying insurance on these mobile phones. And so all that nonsense would go away if we could learn to save $1,000 and then increase that to 1 month of our living expense all the way up to 3 to 6 months. And if you're really able to get disciplined, to get at least 15 months in savings.
Well, you mentioned those long-term, those 401ks, those long-term savings or investing plans. Help us with some general guidelines about that. I mean, some of us, you know, maybe started too late. Others aren't putting enough in or have had to maybe pull out some because of job loss or something. What's your advice on those 401ks and those retirement plans?
Well, we still have a wonderful benefit the government provides for us, which is an incentive to set aside money for our own savings. Of course, if you've been in the workforce and you've been employed, you've been setting aside funds in Social Security, which are yours, which will be paid back to you in over time as we leave the workforce. But it's important to have personal savings as well. The number one regret of retiring seniors is that they say they didn't save early enough or they didn't save enough to maintain their needs throughout retirement. And we're going to see that as a major problem with baby boomers. So my recommendation is to take advantage of all the ways that you can possibly save now, not only in the emergency account, but take advantage of what the company offers. If they offer any kind of matching program, any type of pension or 401k where you can put aside tax-deferred money and they're going to match it, certainly do that. And also take advantage of any of the IRAs that you can start, which is a tax benefit. You usually receive a tax credit. So the government is incentivizing us to do that. And if you're over 50, you have a catch-up plan where you can start adding more each year to be able to make that happen. And those are just financial disciplines that need to happen once you've started to really get control of your finances. I know many people are listening and are feeling like that this feels way too out of reach. But, Neil, over the years I've been doing this, I've met so many people who are driving down the road listening to Christian radio, and they heard me challenge them to start saving money, and that started a whole new chapter of their life. It was something they never thought was possible, but once they started, then it began to cascade into all these other steps. That was the cornerstone of getting financially free. I've met one lady who was a widow when she heard me say this. She had $50,000 in debt, and she started by saving $50, and that began a habit that eventually led her to becoming completely debt-free.
Well, I want to hear more about that and maybe ask Chuck actually just some ways that we can actually – how do we actually go about saving money? I mean, we probably should know how to do that, but there might be some tips or tricks that he has. I also want to talk about, you know, those that have retired so they wish they would have started earlier or had more. Big expense being health care. I want to get some reflection from Chuck on that as well. And to take a question or two from you. Maybe there's an issue you're wondering about, whether it's investments or it's savings or just being a good steward. You can join in the conversation with a phone call at 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484. Chuck Bentley, CEO of Crown Financial Ministries. You hear him daily on the program My Money Life. He's authored several books, including Thrive, How to Do Well in Any Economy. And we'll talk more about that in the moments ahead here on Connecting Faith. We're talking money, stewardship, financial freedom, all those things today with Chuck Bentley. Chuck's heard daily on Faith Radio with My Money Life, and he's been the CEO of Crown Ministries for the last, 10 years or so, anyway, with Crown since year 2000. Travels the globe speaking and addressing churches and business leaders on biblical financial topics. He's written several books, including The SALT Plan, How to Prepare for a Crisis of Biblical Proportions, The Thrive, How to Do Well in Any Economy. He's got a new book coming out here this fall, and we'll maybe touch on that a bit, too. But, Chuck, I just want to talk a little bit about a variety of issues. One of them, when it comes to finances, certainly big expenses. Health care is one. We've been focusing a lot of attention on trying to make some changes in our current system. As we get older, those costs impact us even more, it seems like. What are your thoughts on how we can prepare for those kind of big expenses as we head toward retirement?
Yeah, I think it's very disheartening to see that the government has come to an impasse on providing some sort of solution to a better plan than Obamacare. I do believe that it's a political football right now, and it may be hung up in legislation for a number of years, which means costs are going to continue to rise. I've had a number of calls here to the office of people telling us they just can't afford any more increases in their insurance premiums. So I recommend, first of all, healthy lifestyle. You know, we can do our part. God gives us a body and tells us to take care of it, says it's like the temple of the Lord. And I think taking care of our bodies is something that we as Americans need to really evaluate. I'm looking at my own lifestyle habits and thinking, how can I get better? How can I get more disciplined? How can I be in better shape so that I age well, so that I'm not so prone and vulnerable to need health care? Secondly, there's some really good alternatives that have been developed over the last 10 years to the typical insurance programs. I'm getting a lot of calls here about medical co-ops, and there's a number of good ones out there, Neil. If you're a church-attending believer, you could probably qualify for one of these co-ops and typically lower your insurance costs. You're going from insurance to a medical co-op. Your out-of-pocket costs probably would decrease by 70%. My oldest son and his wife, who have four children, have been on that plan for a number of years, and they've been extremely happy with the plan they've been on. That's an alternative as well. I think also trying to save money where you can lower your deductible cost or raise your deductible cost so you can lower your premium cost. I have what's called a high deductible health plan. That means I have to come out of pocket if I go to see a doctor. And so we've saved money to be able to do that. But my monthly premium costs have come way down for our family. So those are some of the suggestions to be prepared for that.
Chuck, I'm interested. Are the issues that we experience, whether it's concerns about health care or taxes or just not having any savings, are they the same as you travel around? I know you've been kind of on a world tour these days. Is South America, Africa, Asia facing some of the same issues we are?
Well, it depends on where you go. I've been to Australia, New Zealand, Namibia, Zimbabwe this year. We've also sent teams in throughout Asia. We were in Hong Kong and Taiwan and Thailand, Germany, and also in Poland this year so far. And everybody's concerned about the global economy. We are a global economy now. Everybody's worried about what President Trump is going to do. It was surprising to me to be in airports in different parts of the world and see people wearing red hats, make America great again. There's a lot of optimism about President Trump. The press portrays this move of this election of him as a global embarrassment. I found that's not to be the case. But people are worried about what's going to happen to the global economy and how to be prepared. And they're preparing at various levels. In the Asian culture, they're tremendous savers. And so they don't feel as vulnerable to a global economic downturn as, say, the people of Africa would feel, or even the people of Australia. They have a much higher savings rate than we do. They have a much stronger banking system than we do. And they don't feel this sort of overhang of a potential for their government to spend them into crazy amounts of deficits as we're living with. So it just depends on where we look, Neil, but certainly the scripture would hold true wherever I go. Proverbs 21:20 says, "The wise man saves for the future, but the foolish man spends whatever he gets." And I think that's a great verse to commit to memory, that if we want to be wise, if we want to do our part, if we want to reflect God's wisdom in our life, then we need to learn to be savers. I have people challenge me sometimes, Neil, to say, "Well, you know, I think that's contrary to faith to save money." And I say, not according to the Bible. You know, God said, if an ant can do it, you can too. Learn to save and demonstrate the wisdom of God so that we're not people who are living on the financial cliff at all times.
There is always that balance, I guess, that tension, isn't it, between planning ahead and trusting God to provide. Is that just a matter of digging into Scripture more, or are there some principles that we should apply?
I think it is a tension. I think that's very well described, Neil. It's a tension because the problem with having savings and the problem with having money set aside is Satan will tempt us to place our confidence in it. But the Scripture wisely tells us to not put our hope in money. Hebrews 13:5 says, keep your lives free from the love of money. I like to say, keep your life free from having any confidence in money. Don't depend on it. Because God has said, I will never leave you or forsake you. He's crying out to us to keep our dependency on God. Money will fly away. Money will disappoint us. It's a temporary tool. It's helpful to have it set aside, but it was never intended to replace what God can do. God is our provider. God is our comforter. God is the one who will always be with us, no matter how much we suffer or how difficult it is if we lose our job. So we keep our confidence in him, even though we have some money in our bank account.
You know, we're coming up here on Faith Radio to our spring fundraiser, and it's a time where we, you know, ask our listeners to partner in faith with what God has provided for this ministry. Just say a word about, you know, when opportunities come for us to give to ministries, so how do you advise people to just decide on what they should do and where?
Well, I think when you look at the parable of the talents, that God's evaluating the stewardship or the management of his funds by three different people, the one with five talents, two talents, and one talent. And much to everybody's shock and chagrin, the person with only one talent received the poorest evaluation. In fact, the Lord said to him, you should have. Now, Neil, if my wife ever starts a conversation with those words, I know something good is not coming. I mean, I can go to the grocery store, and if I get home, she said, you should have, and I know I've messed up immediately. Well, Jesus used those words to the steward with one talent. You should have put the money on loan with a banker. And what he's saying there is you should have done something to get at least a minimal amount of return, even if it was a low-risk, low-yield, something should have been returned to my kingdom. And I think he's saying in that parable, nobody is exempt from giving. We should all be giving and investing in the kingdom, especially those of us who name his name, who worship him and depend on him. And I think the Scripture makes it clear we're to give where we're being fed. And I've always been a supporter of the local radio station where my wife and I receive teaching. We believe in Christian radio. Not only am I providing content for Christian radio, but I receive content from Christian radio. I was in my car at lunch today, and a song came on that my son wrote. My son's a Christian musician, and he's written some songs that have done very well. And it brought tears to my eyes of thinking how many people could be listening to that song or hearing that song today and being blessed and drawing closer to the Lord. So I encourage people to give to Christian radio because it makes so much sense. It's still so efficient. You know, the studies show that I think Christian radio will touch 94% of the people driving in their cars at any given time. It's just a huge reach, and it's a meaningful reach. It's bringing the light into a dark world, and we so desperately need Christian radio now. So, Neil, I get passionate about it. I appreciate what Christian radio means to this country. I go to places where you can't have Christian broadcasting, and you have to say certain words very carefully, and it's illegal to present the gospel. And God forbid that that day would ever come to our country. And it will come if we become lackadaisical and we take for granted the hard work that people like you and the network do and the university do to make Christian radio possible. And so we need to give. We need to make an investment and to give liberally and generously to Christian radio. To me, it's a great place to trust other people to get a high yield for God's kingdom on my behalf.
Good word, Chuck. Thank you for that. I'm just curious, we got only just a minute or so left, but are there some ways that you recommend for us maybe to get into a savings plan just to get started with something? Do you, you know, toss your coins in a can, or what works for you?
Well, we try to do everything. We've got a whole portfolio of ways we save. I save all of my coins. You know, if I break a bill during the day, all the coins go in a jar, and we roll those up at the end of the year. That's usually anywhere from $200 to $300 that we set aside just for fun. The boys count the change every year and roll those coins, and just to show them that it's little things add up to big things. We also have automatic withdrawal from my paycheck every 2 weeks. Money gets set aside in an account that we don't touch. And then we'll do things like we'll take a challenge where we declare to each other, my wife and I say, all right, we're not going to spend any money this week, although it was in our budget. We're just going to fast from any spending, and we're going to set that extra $100 or $200 aside for savings. We got something coming up, you know, new tires we're going to need, and we just want to be sure that we're not squeaking by to get those done. So we'll cut back on spending some way. I love the $5 bill challenge that we've talked about where every time you touch a $5 bill, set it aside, only spend the ones, the tens, the 20s, 50s, and the hundreds, and save every $5 bill that you touch. There's just a lot of methods. Going to an envelope system where you break your budget down into envelopes and carry them around, carry the cash with you. And if you don't spend it that month, then set it aside in a savings envelope. But it can be done, Neil, and I think if one thing happened today that we encourage some of your listeners to develop financial margin, to be that wise person that saves for the future, then this would have been a good investment of our time today, brother.
I always appreciate the time with Chuck Bentley, Crown Financial Ministries CEO. You can find out more at crown.org and look for Chuck's good words on My Money Life each day here on Faith Radio. Chuck, blessings to you. Thanks for jumping in with us today.
Blessings to you, Neil, and I hope your listeners will get be a part of SHARE next week and that they will fund this wonderful ministry. And thank you for what you're doing.
Chuck Bentley joining us here on Connecting Faith. Coming up in a moment, Rick Mattson joins us again for another session about sharing our faith. Stay tuned. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and today we want to see if we can be more intentional about connecting the faith that we hold so dear with those who don't yet know Jesus and have a personal relationship with Him. You know, being ready to give an answer for the hope that we have doesn't just happen without preparation and attention, and we're getting some opportunity today on Connecting Faith to get practical approaches and lessons on more effectively sharing our faith with the friends and neighbors who may be skeptical. And to do that, we've asked Rick Mattson back in the studio. He's an apologetic specialist for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. He served as a staff worker on college campuses for 30-some years, of serving both McAllister College and St. Olaf College in Minnesota, and frequently travels to colleges and universities across the country. And he's also written a great book called Faith is Like Skydiving and Other Memorable Images for Dialogue with Seekers and Skeptics. And Rick, I know you do encounter seekers and skeptics a lot of time, and maybe more of us do all the time, too. And it's not simply just sharing four spiritual laws anymore, is it?
No, no. Post-Christian society means that people don't have they don't have a stronger Christian memory of really what Christian principles are. And so the gap, I think, is getting wider between secular culture and those of us who call ourselves Christian. And so more work has to be done to bridge that gap. You can't just walk in and assume, for example, that people even think that the Bible is authoritative or even relevant anymore.
So are there ways that we can actually take a conversation, move it forward, have a spiritual conversation? I mean, starting one is maybe kind of challenging for some people, but then to keep it moving.
Yeah. Doug Shoup and Don Everts have written a book called I Once Was Lost. And that book is a wonderful treatment of how people move from unbelief to belief in these postmodern times. And they lay out what they call five thresholds of conversion. So when you first get into a conversation with someone, the first thing that might happen is that they just learn to trust a Christian. So that's threshold one, is just trust a Christian. And then secondly, they become curious, like, well, there's something about this person that's intriguing. I want to know more. I want to know why they believe. And a skeptic might say, gosh, I would never believe, but this person seems bright enough and they believe, so that so there's curiosity there. And then the third threshold is them becoming open to change. And that's actually probably the hardest one to go through. Someone might have idle curiosity, they might trust a Christian, but to actually be open to changing their life and their worldview, open to Jesus, that is the one that's hardest to get through. And then fourthly, becoming a true seeker. So number one, trusting a Christian. Secondly, becoming curious. Thirdly, being open to change. Fourthly, becoming a true seeker. And then fifthly, crossing the line. So what's really helpful about that template is if you know where your friend is in their journey, then you can do things that really make sense for that particular threshold. So you wouldn't necessarily assume that just because someone trusts a Christian that they're a true seeker. And you might want to go back and do things that are a little bit more basic than assume they'd want to go to a Christian concert or come and hear a church service or something. They might not want to do that at all. And the five thresholds kind of guide us through that process.
Which, again, I guess maybe takes some of the pressure off us having to think in terms of, well, it's got to be from A to Z. It's just moving, taking the next step.
Taking the next step. That's exactly right. I think sometimes Christians get discouraged that, oh, I didn't share the whole gospel today, or the person didn't come to faith, or and we're thinking of days gone by, the tent meetings and so forth in this country. But I think these days it's a lot slower process. People need to think through all these implications, and we need to give the Holy Spirit time to work in their lives and pay attention to what the Holy Spirit is doing in their lives and walk kind of at their pace. Can I say that? Yeah, we walk at their pace and not expect them to walk at our pace. And sometimes it's slow going, and that's exactly what God has called us to do today. Walk slowly with this person. And then when they move forward, we move forward. Don't get ahead of the Spirit. Don't get behind the Spirit. That's the trick here, I guess.
Having that template in mind, has that helped you in your conversations with the students or faculty or friends and neighbors?
Oh, very much so. One of the first things that I do when I get into a conversation is try to assess, where is this person? Like, I'm the detective. That's what evangelism is. It's detective work. It's discerning where God has brought this person. What is God doing in this person's life? And once I zero in on that, then I can begin to say the things and do the things that will make sense for that particular point in their journey. So my friend Tom was a real lawyer and a bright agnostic atheist person. And it just reminds me that this whole endeavor of sharing faith with other people is often done in community. So Tom was attending a Lutheran church because even though he was very skeptical, he was curious. He wanted to be there and see what it was like. And the way he tells it to me, there is this big poster at the Lutheran church. And it's a poster of Jesus. It's a painting of Jesus, I should say. Every time he came around the corner, he would see that painting. And the caption underneath it is, "Who do you say that I am?" And he knew that he had to answer that question for himself. Who do you say that I am? And he finally read Lee Strobel, The Case for Christ, and I had conversations with him, and other people did as well. And so it was great to see Tom go from trusting a Christian in his skepticism to becoming curious and then actually open to change. That was the amazing thing for this really bright lawyer with a philosophy education at Notre Dame. And, he's a real bright guy. And then a true seeker in the end. And then through reading Lee Strobel and having conversations with us, he came to faith out of his atheism. And that was just so good to see walk right through those five thresholds there.
There are often times along the way, maybe most often along the way, there are questions that come up, right, that maybe barriers or, hard questions that we don't always feel prepared to answer. So talk about some of those.
Yeah, one that comes up a lot is, why does God allow suffering? And this is a long topic, and we should spend an hour on it someday.
Sure.
But I do have kind of an elevator speech on this that can – a few bullet points. One is, we live in a broken world. God allows suffering because we caused it. We're the ones who rebelled against him, and he's allowing the consequences of our sin to play themselves out in our lives. And so he doesn't always just jump in and fix things. We exercised our free will to create a divorce in our relationship with God. What C.S. Lewis calls the great divorce. And then I think there's a developmental model as well. God isn't so much in the business of just snapping his fingers and making all the suffering and evil go away in the world. James 1, 2 to 4, I'll quote it right here. Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. And then James goes on to talk about the benefits of that. So I think we live in a broken world. God calls us to be ministers in a broken world. I was at South Dakota State the other day. I was speaking at a fraternity, and there's guys there. Some were of faith and some not so much. And I was telling the story of how my wife, Sharon, had some suffering. She had a chronic shoulder injury, and it would just not heal up. And our friends, Michael and Rachel, at church one day came up and laid hands on Sharon's shoulder and prayed, and Sharon was healed that very day after 8 months of suffering through with that thing. And it was just the power of God. And so I was telling the story to the frat boys at South Dakota State, and one of the guys said, okay, well, God cares about Sharon's shoulder, but apparently he doesn't care about the starving children in India because he's not doing anything about that. And I said, no, he cares about the starving children in India even more than he cares about Sharon's shoulder. In fact, Sharon's shoulder is a symbol. It's a sign. It's a clue that God cares about greater ills and greater suffering in our world. Well, as it turns out, Sharon went on a mission trip to India last summer and brought the love and healing of Christ on this mission trip to Hyderabad, India. And I thought that was just a way for the Lord to close the circle there. Anyway, we're talking about, why does God allow pain, suffering, and evil? And it's because of our free will, but he's calling us to get out there in the power of the Holy Spirit to do something about the ills in the world.
Yeah. We're also in a time in our culture where science seems like that's the most important element on campus, right? I mean, that's our new God.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Science has been very successful. It has a lot of prestige in the academy. I guess what I want to say back to the person who says, hey, why do I need God if I've got science? I don't think God is just an explanation. It's a lifestyle. So these are not necessarily two competing explanations. Oh, God did it, or science explains it through natural law. It's not always that. Sometimes it does get down to that. But God is a person that we worship and that we obey. We're in a loving relationship with. And so there's not necessarily a direct conflict with science. Besides, science only tells us about the physical world. It doesn't tell us how to live. It might make some recommendations, but science isn't ethics. It's not morality. Science is experimentation and prediction. And I guess as a Christian, I would just say, Neil, science is a gift from God. Would I rather be an atheist with just science or a Christian with science and God? That's an easy one for me. I'll take both, you know. I have this analogy. It's in my book, The Shrinking Island Analogy. Here goes. Shrinking Island Analogy. We think the island in the water is God, and the water around the island is science. And as the water rises, God, who is the island, shrinks. But the analogy is this. The island actually isn't God. The shrinking island isn't God. The shrinking island is ignorance. And the gift of science is the water, and as the water rises, God helps us to overcome ignorance, helps us understand the world that he created. It's an orderly world, and the gift of science enables us to study it and make the world a better place.
You'll find more great ways to maybe start dialogue with seekers and skeptics from Rick Matson's book, Faith is Like Skydiving, and other memorable images for dialogue with seekers and skeptics. Rick's an apologetic specialist for the Embarcer Christian Fellowship and serves on the McAllister College and Stanislaus College campuses in Minnesota, as well as travels frequently across the country speaking in colleges and university campuses. Joining us today on Connecting Faith, I want to recommend to the other book we referenced, I Once Was Lost. You'll find that a very helpful resource, as hopefully our time together will be great, filled with resources here as we visit here each time when we get together. Rick, good to see you again. Thank you.
Thanks, Neil.
By the way, you can connect with Rick on his website or email at rickmatsonoutreach.com, rickmatsonoutreach.com. He's a regular contributor to Connecting Faith, and look forward to our next visit with him. And look forward to tomorrow's conversation with Barbara Rainey and Susan Yates. We're going to talk Barbara and Susan's Guide to the Empty Nest. Great advice for those that are in that season of life. Listen for it tomorrow on Connecting Faith on Faith Radio.
Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support, And you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.